And this is it. This is it right now. We are live. We are officially live. It is the grand, it is the season premiere of Dead Sexy, our brand new show, which we did not, we decided not to do because it was too sexy.
Yeah.
That was the consensus, correct? With our, what do they call the test audience? You know, they bring a bunch of people in.
Focus group.
Focus group. There we go. I can always count on you to know stuff, Shay. That's why I love you so much.
That's why I'm here.
More or less. And that's literally still the reason I keep you around. So it's been 2-3 weeks of like absolute murder mayhem. We have been researching serial killers. We have been reading about the legal process. We have been, you know, learning more about detective work in the field of like mind fuckery. And I want to see if you would be able at this point to spot a serial killer in a crowd. And you know, you're a pretty smart guy.
Okay.
And it's not a secret. This is like when I can't think of something to say, that's the thing I fall back on. It's like, you're smart.
Okay.
Where am I going with this? Shay, apparently there are 11 common signs of a serial killer. How many do you think you can name? Or if you name five, do you think you can get at least five correct?
Do I think if I name five, do I think I'll get all five correct? Is that your question?
You tell me what the question is. I've given you the parameters of what could be a question.
Oh, shit.
Why don't you kind of decide what you want to do from here?
I'll help you out, Ian. All right. So
thanks, bud.
So there's 11 characteristics. Shay, how many can you name? All right. So.
Yeah. Hey, great question.
I'm going to guess, I don't know, zero. I'll go off of what I think are common characteristics. I think
common signs, characteristics.
All right.
I mean, they're probably.
Oh, I know this. I know one of them, right? It's they like beat animals or like abusive towards animals.
Animal abuse. Okay.
Is that one?
That's one. Yeah. I'll give
Hell
you that.
Yeah. Does mental illness, is that too broad?
I would say like, I don't know. I feel like being a serial killer is a mental illness.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. Is it common characteristics or like everyone has this?
Common. I would say common in a serial killer.
Male.
You're either being clever in like a not a cute way at all, or you're doing a really bad job.
I think that counts. I'm gonna say probably most serial killers, if like 95%.
You're right about that. You are correct about that. You are absolutely correct about that. So yeah, sure, I'll give it to you.
Okay, is it with the what is it, XXY chromosomes or XYX chromosomes or something?
What are you doing right now?
That's like, a thing, right?
This is supposed to be just like a fun, simple exercise, and you have decided to, I don't even know what you're doing right now. You're doing this thing you always do. You're hijacking my fun. You're making it all about you. You know what? You're a serial killer, and you serial kill my very nice and fun cold opens.
Okay, that's fair. Do you want to
start the show?
Okay, let's start the show.
All right. Start the show!
Hello everyone, and welcome to Camp Reeducation, an immersive boot camp into the world we thought we knew. We are your hosts, Ian and Shay, concluding our 2-week immersion into the world of true crime.
I like the way you said that, kind of, you were like, I don't know, you know how some superheroes get like a reveal, like Ian and Shay.
Ian and Shay. Ian today's and episode.
I guess this is like a Japanese cartoon. Anyway, so some of you were wondering before the break in our theme song, what are the 11 common signs of a serial killer? Well, according to serialkillershop.com, gotta start checking my sources. Gotta do a better job. 11 common signs. I guess this is all they do. Maybe they're a reliable enough source.
Yeah.
So like, I'm just going to kind of go through this list a little quick. Let's put some music underneath this. Lack of empathy, lack of remorse, impulsivity, grandiosity, narcissism, superficial charm, manipulation, addictive personality, lust for power, sensation seeking, and finally, the McDonald triad, which we all know means wetting your bed, starting fires, and abusing animals.
Did you say the McDonald's triad?
The
what'd you say?
It's the McDonald, not like McDonald's.
I was like, what kind of a weird joke? Is this like everyone who loves McDonald loves starting fires and wetting the bed?
Mommy, can we get a kid's meal and then start a fire? Like, oh my God, Billy.
You're on to something, little Billy.
Do you want to kill mommy? Of course! You know, the McDonald's, I guess, formulated by a psychologist named McDonald, that serial killers had the traits of wetting the bed, being bedwetters, being prone to arson, and torturing animals. And apparently this is under heavy scrutiny, because I guess in the past couple of years, it's come out that, like, you know, bedwetting, cruelty to animals, these are characteristics of someone who's, like, being abused, not necessarily someone who is a serial killer. Like, if you're abused physically and psychologically, you're more prone to bedwetting, like destruction and, perpetuating systems of or behavior that is cruel.
That makes a lot of sense to me. And I think you're really setting the stage for what we're going to be talking about this episode. So before we get too far into that, we do have a featured artist this week. None other than, of course, this year's favorite indie darling. That is Piper King. You can hear them starting up beneath us now. I'm like really like starting words.
They really started. They're like they're tickling the genitalia as they rise.
Oh God, they're gonna hate that. Anyway, this is Piper King with the song Not That Bad. And if you stick around to the end of the episode, you can hear the entire song and of course its entirety. So definitely do that. Well worth the wait. And they're also gonna be on our Spotify and
I'd say it's pretty damn good, and that was not a pun worth cutting you off. Speaking of cutting you off, we've got some serial killer stuff today. So as you know, it is part two of Serial Killer Camp. We are at the end of our immersion, and true to form, camp re-education style, the only way to truly understand something is to do it. Unless you can't do it, then it's to do the other version of the thing, which is making a podcast about true crime. Shay actually proposed killing people. I, being the voice of reason on the show, the famed voice of reason, decidedly said, maybe next time.
You're the show's coward, is what you are, Ian. You're afraid of fun and new things.
You're the show's coward. But, speaking of cowards, here's a quick interjection. Last episode, a couple episodes earlier, Shay and I had some loving conversations with our friend Andrew Hillary and each other about penis sizes, self-conscious male shit. And super fan of the show, Sarah Broski, reached out to us and let us know scientifically that a good-sized penis is apparently between 5.5 to 6.5 inches. That is the preferred size. She is our voice of reason. She has spoken. That is the only good penis size. If you're bigger than that, you're a freak. You're a monster, and God will kill you.
So putting you on the spot, Ian, what if you're smaller than that? What do you, when I say, well,
okay, first of all, okay,
you know,
I'm sorry, you fall outside of the range of a good size.
To any listeners,
and I'm in the range.
To any listeners at home who may fall beneath it, Ian, I know you don't want to insult them. What are you going to say to them?
Sarah said that she thinks penis size is also not correlated to being able to please your partner. And, she said, while that is preferable between her and many of her friends who have spoken on the subject, being above or below that doesn't mean that you cannot be a fantastic lover. So Sarah, thank you for being the show's scientist. You know, she actually said, when she told me this, she went, you know, I was a neuroscientist. And I said, I had no idea there were so many good-sized penises in the brain.
That's true.
We learn something new every day.
That's truly amazing. Well, great. So we do have a great episode in store for everyone. So we're each going to tell a little story today. We're diving into true crime face first. And so I guess we can do that now. I don't know why else we wouldn't. You know, what's stopping us? This is our show, Ian. If we want to tell a story right now, we can just do it.
We can.
Yeah.
By the way, really quick, is that a tautology or is that a redundancy, I guess, to saying we're diving in face first? Because isn't that how diving works?
I think you normally dive in hands first.
Is it like more of like a torpedo thing if you go face first?
I guess, but I'm also now thinking like I know if you're actually diving, you go in back first.
Wait, what?
Yeah, if you're diving, like you go off the boat, you have your diving tank behind you, and you sit on the edge of the boat, and you fall backwards, and you go tank first.
I was thinking diving board diving.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, there's lots of different ways to dive, Ian.
I know going ass first is just called a cannonball. So I was just like, all right, hold on. I need to get to the bottom of things. All right. So anyway, tangents aside, we've got some great content for you. And starting us off is none other than Camp Reeducation's very own Shay Langford with the story of the Gainesville Ripper. Shay, take us there.
All right, guys. I've never done this before, so I'm actually really excited. When I say I've never done this before, I did this once like 2 hours ago with my girlfriend. So we'll see how this goes. Ian and I are both from, or not both from, but we went to college in Gainesville. So it felt more than appropriate for us to cover the Gainesville Ripper, which is like, it's a story that kind of hovered over the Gainesville experience, like in the background, but it was always there. You know, you could always rely on it if you wanted a good spook on your way home. And of course, that's why I'm wearing my Florida Gators hoodie, and why, of course, let's see if I can do this. I have orange, and over there, Ian, wave to me, Ian.
Wait, where are you? There you are.
I'm that way. Yeah, there. Hey, Ian's got the blue, orange, blue Gator colors. We know
that.
So that was fun. Little Brady Bunch action.
Oh my god.
I've had a lot of coffee today. I'm like definitely burning out a little bit. So, all right. So the Gainesville Ripper.
Yeah.
So maybe you've heard about this. Maybe you haven't. I'm not going to tell the full story because there are so many incredible details in this story that like really fill out this world building of the character of Danny Rollins. We're going to hit the major points here. And if that's not enough for you, then, you know, there's a lot of other places you can find the story. But, all right.
What are you doing? Like, yeah, if this doesn't cut it for you, just go somewhere else.
If this sucks, you know, find a better podcast. They're definitely out there. All right. So, like Ian mentioned at the beginning of the episode, a lot of these things start in childhood. And I think, you know, we've talked about this before, that hurt people. Everyone knows that, right? And so this is the story of hurting people.
Yeah. Oh my God. I don't know. Like, it's never totally acceptable, but like, there are times it goes way out of bounds.
Yeah.
I think this qualifies.
I'm not saying he's justified. I'm just saying, probably if he wasn't abused horribly his entire life, he probably wouldn't have been so abusive himself. I mean, it's like your programming. Anyway, we'll get to this later.
Yeah.
So Danny Rollins, born to James Rollins and Claudia Rollins, his mother, James Rollins, his father, was an incredibly abusive piece of shit. He was a former police officer. Used to beat the shit out of him and his younger brother their entire lives. It never escaped the types of emotional, physical, and psychological abuse in like a number of ways, just all throughout growing up. His dad would have him arrested by his police officer friends, handcuff him and leave him there.
Just what, like, the fuck?
Fucked up shit and just like really awful stuff. And obviously, like, this affected him a lot. Like, he was in and out of trouble. Like, his teachers would always say horrible things about, or not horrible things, but like, comment on his horrible behavior. Like, I know his school counselors described him once as, quote, suffering from an inferiority complex with aggressive tendencies and poor impulse control, which, knowing who he becomes later, you can just see the writing on the wall, right?
Oh my God.
So, he basically was abused a bunch, ended up marrying a woman kind of early in life, And it wasn't long after they got married that they ended up getting divorced. She divorced him after getting death threats. She was like, you know what? Actually, I don't think I want to stay with you. And following that divorce, he basically just spiraled. Everything after that was awful. He accidentally killed a woman in a car accident, raped another woman who looked... I thought you were shushing me, and I was like, I have a lot more. No,
And I've heard enough, Shay. This concludes Dead Sexy. Yeah.
So, he got sentenced to jail a bunch of times for a number of different things. He ended up early on, he started robbing places, and this was just like a thing he would just do. He just started robbing places, holding people up at gunpoint, stealing, and in and out of jail. Yeah.
Did you say this was in the 70s, by the way?
This was the 70s and the 80s, yeah.
What was it about the 70s and the 80s when like you could literally rob a store at gunpoint and get like a weekend in jail?
Right?
Like, that was your fucking punishment.
And he escaped from jail twice. Apparently one time he literally just walked away from jail, and that's how he escaped. Like, no one stopped him or anything.
He just walked. That's how he got away. He didn't run, he walked.
Yeah.
And the guards were like, he was a prisoner. He wouldn't be walking. He'd be running.
So I think it's worth stating that this is all from Shreveport, Louisiana. This is where all of this happened. This is where he grew up. And if you don't know anything about Shreveport, shame on you. Everyone knows that it's the third largest city or municipality in Louisiana, second only, of course, to Baton Rouge and New Orleans. So if you didn't know, now you know. But yeah, Backwards Town, it's actually... interesting to me, probably few others, but it's approximately the same size as Gainesville, where he later gets his famous nickname.
I don't know why that got that gave me goosebumps for some weird reason. I don't know. Maybe I'm a bad person. Like the the car crash, the rape. I was like, I par for the course for a serial killer. But it was like, and this other town was the same size as the town in which he would kill. And I was like, ooh,
spooky.
Ooh, spooky.
So a lot of just accidental killings, some raping, some murdering, some like assault. All of this led him to the year 1989. Which in 1989, some of you may know, was the year that Ted Bundy was electrocuted in the electric chair. This was everywhere. Everyone was thinking about Ted Bundy, serial killer. It was like almost like serial killer mania back in this time in like the late 80s, early 90s. So this is kind of the atmosphere where we're seeing Danny Rollins kind of live and exist in this time period. So his... I guess psychological state continuously deteriorating until the point, and this is the super important date, and I want you to remember this date. The date was May 17, 1990, where everything changed. Ian, do you know that date?
May 17th, 1990. Is it your fucking birthday?
That's my birthday!
Because I was like, wait, mine's May 24th. Who's this May? Like, oh, well, yeah.
That's the day I was born.
Oh, my God.
Isn't that cool?
I was like, wow, he's doing a great job setting this up.
Like, yeah, that's
fuck, even I want to know what this date is now.
Well, that's my birthday. Now everyone knows my birthday. Congratulations. May 17th, that's my birthday. But the next day, May 18th, was the snapping point for Mr. Rollins. This is the day he gets into a fight. He's at his parents' house. I don't even know if it's fair to call it a snapping point because he had been doing so much fucked up shit before this point. Like, it was really just
doing
like
a lot of snapping.
Yeah, there was a lot of small snaps, but this was a bigger snap. So he gets into a fight with his dad, his abusive dad who'd been beating the shit out of him his entire life.
Yeah.
Takes out a gun, shoots him in the stomach and in the head. His dad survives, but loses an eye and an ear.
How bad of a shot do you have to be?
Like, I have no idea.
To shoot your fat cop dad in the stomach and in the head and have him... No wonder he became a serial killer, man. He's like, I have to prove I can do this.
Yeah. So this was May 18th, 1990. He basically, he leaves. He's like now kind of on the low. He's like wanted again. You know, he shot his dad. Yeah. He's doing a ton of B&Es, breaks into this house, finds a bunch of identification papers from a man, a young man who had died named Michael Kennedy Jr., who you may know him as the son of none other than Michael Kennedy Sr. That's right. Yeah, his dad.
Nice.
So
round of applause for that joke, ladies and gentlemen, because that was good.
So he takes these identities, or he takes these documents and assumes the identity of Michael Kennedy Jr., gets on a Greyhound bus and leaves Shreveport, Louisiana for Sarasota, Florida. He's doing the same shady shit he was doing, like stealing cars, robbing convenience stores, grocery stores, got a hotel. Like he's making pretty good money, making a bunch of money. I mean, not somehow, obviously he's stealing the money, but he's making quite a bit of
money. It's a mystery.
How is he doing that? So he takes, he hangs out there for a little while. But apparently, I think I somewhere along the line, he's like, he wants to go where there's prettier women. Somehow he hears about Gainesville, Florida. And he goes from Sarasota to Tampa, hangs out in Tampa for a couple days, and then steals a car and goes to Gainesville, Florida. It's now August. The semester, the 1990 fall semester of Gainesville is starting. And Ian, you and I, we're from Gainesville. We know like the atmosphere, the energy.
The energy, it's huge.
It's everywhere, right? It's like all consuming.
Yeah, everyone's stoked to be there. Like, you know, being a young man in Gainesville, Florida, like in overwhelming how many attractive people there are. And you're just like, oh my God, like everyone's so excited. Like everyone's full of potential. And it's just like,
yeah.
Oh my God, Jesus Christ.
So that's the stage. He's arriving there. He's experiencing this himself. He ends up setting a one-man, like a tenty, like shanty campsite south of the University of Florida. And since I know you and I know where that is, he ended up having a campsite. I'm pretty sure it was south of Archer Road, just beneath the university. God. And had like this little campsite out there. So
I guess really, really quick too, like, so for anybody like not super familiar with Gainesville, maybe familiar with college towns, Gainesville's nickname is called the Swamp because it is below sea level. It is incredibly hot, but I mean, even now, but probably especially in the 90s, very easy place to hide. Mm. Lots of woods, plenty of back roads, not a lot of light in plenty of instances. Like it's probably a really great place for a serial killer to kind of like start being a serial killer.
Yeah. And also, it's definitely not below sea level. It's 177 feet above sea level. I Googled it.
You know what? If you're below 200 feet above sea level, you're below sea level. If you're above, if you're not above 200, you're just, it's below. Let's not get carried away.
And oh, and of course, this was Danny Rollins was obsessed with sea level. It's all he would ever talk about.
Oh, God.
I'm just kidding.
Ian, you're exhibiting some very troubling characteristics here.
You didn't mention this on your 11 characteristics. Of
I'm going to Gainesville because it's below sea level.
So, early August, Gainesville.
Oh, man.
So, takes us to the early morning of Friday, August 24th, again, 1990. There are two women, Sonia Larson and Christina Powell, both 17, both college freshmen. God. They just moved to Gainesville. They're living together.
How are they college freshmen at 17? What the hell was going on in 1990?
I don't know. I don't know how that, like, I feel like that wasn't my experience, but maybe they're really bright college freshmen. I'm not sure.
Oh, God.
So they're living together. I'm actually not sure if this was like premeditated, like if he had scoped these young women out in particular or not, but early morning, breaks into their house, sees Christina Powell asleep on a couch, sees her there, doesn't do anything, and just walks past her because I think he knows that the other young lady, Sonia Larson, was asleep upstairs. And I don't want to go into too many details because they're really fucking gruesome, but the cliff notes here are breaks into her room, duct tapes her hands and her mouth, cuts off her clothes, and then rapes her. And I believe it's either while raping her or shortly after, stabs her to death. Somehow, downstairs, Christina Powell doesn't hear the commotion. He goes down, tapes her hands, tapes her mouth, rapes her, and then stabs her in the back as well. And they both die. Afterwards, he poses their bodies in like sexually explicit ways. He mutilates the bodies. I believe he cuts off one of their nipples and takes it with him, at least one of their nipples.
Oh, and Jesus.
He even, and then after all this is done, he takes a shower before he leaves. That's Friday, August 24th, 1990. The next day, August 25th, the house of Krista Hoyt, 18, also a freshman at Santa Fe Community College.
That's where I went. Fuck.
I went there too. I did a semester
there.
I didn't
realize there as well. I didn't know you were a Santa Fe boy.
I was, both. I did the anyway. So yeah, whatever.
Stole a car from Tampa, drove up to Gainesville, started community college.
Jesus Christ.
Serial killed everyone's expectations and succeeded, all right? You know?
Oh, God. This is such a weird feeling to, like, the high and the low, like, the darkness. Oh, my God.
I definitely see the whole humor coping with death thing because I'm so uncomfortable.
You're like, oh, how do I do it?
Oh, my God. Oh, fuck.
So the very next day, it's Saturday, August 25th. He sneaks into the apartment of Krista Hoyt, 18-year-old Santa Fe student. He sneaks into by opening a sliding glass door. And apparently, I believe he did this with most of his entries were prying open sliding glass doors using...
It's very easy to pry open if you have a flathead screwdriver.
Well, in fact, what he used, though, was a K-bar knife made by the Cutco company. And I know I'd asked you before, Ian, are you familiar with Cutco?
Correct me if I'm wrong. They are the knives that you see on late night infomercials where the guy is like, this knife is so sharp here. Watch this. Watch what I'm about to do. This is a can of Coca-Cola. Right through the can. Is it that knife?
I have no idea. But it's at least the knife that Vector Marketing uses. Cutco, Vector Marketing, they're all the same. It's basically a multi-level marketing scheme, an MLM that preys on college students that to encourage them to like sell knives, guilt their friends and family to buy knives from them because it's like their first college job. And like, you can like recruit other people. It's a whole fucking scheme. And like,
it's a pyramid scheme.
It's basically a pyramid scheme. And I've had friends who got burned by Cutco, like, and you know, their freshman, sophomore year. And so like, I fucking hate Cutco. And if you don't yet, or if you already do, and you're looking for more reasons to hate Cutco, it's the official knife of the Gainesville Ripper. So,
oh my God. If you need another reason to hate Cutco, kill your way to success.
If it ain't Cutco, are you really even a murderer? So,
if it ain't Cutco, are you even killing them?
God, you know what's funny is like I wanted to comedic effect to jump into like something really dark, and I was like, even that feels like fucking weird. But anyway, enough fourth wall. So he. God.
So, anyway, murders.
Back to the morning of Saturday, August 25th.
Oh my God, fuck.
He's breaking in to the sliding glass door with a Cutco knife.
Oh God.
He breaks into her apartment, surprises her, gets her in a chokehold, and subdues her. And then from here, it's a similar story to what happens before. He tapes her hands, mouth, cuts off her clothes, has sex with her face down, and then stabs her in the back. This might be the most disturbing of the murders because he then decapitates her.
Oh, Jesus.
Puts her head on a bookshelf across the room facing her dead body. And then, like the other bodies, poses her body in a sexual way before leaving.
Jesus Christ.
It's the next day. Everyone finds out about it. Everyone's talking about it. It's now Sunday, August 25th. This has now made national headlines. People are fucking terrified. Over the next couple days, thousands of students unenroll and leave UF, leave Santa Fe, leave Gainesville.
It's a
terror across the entire city. People are freaked the fuck out. This makes national headlines. Everyone's talking about the Gainesville Ripper. I guess it's Sunday, August 26th. I guess he was a religious man, so I guess maybe he took the Sabbath off, just, you know, had a hymn day, a day for himself. And then on Monday, August 27th, he's back to work. He goes to the home of Tracy Pauls, 23, also a student, who I don't know if the Gainesville Ripper knew this, but she also had a male roommate, also 23, named Manny Tabawada. I might be pronouncing that wrong. Broke into the apartment with the exact same Cutco brand K-bar knife. Finds the man. They get into a brief fight, causing a huge commotion. He's able to overpower the man and kills him. Leaves him very unceremoniously on the ground while Tracy comes down. Here's what is happening. Tries to run up back into her room, barricade the door. Danny Rollins is able to break in. And then there's the familiar story. Hands taped, mouth taped, raped, and stabbed to death. This body was not ceremoniously positioned. There was less mutilation. I think there maybe for fear that there was too much commotion, and so he just left. And that was the fourth and fifth final murders of the Gainesville Ripper's murder spree. All of these victims were Caucasian brunettes with brown eyes, with the exception of the man, Manny Tabawada. After all of this happened, only 700 students never returned back to Gainesville. They completely withdrew and stayed away. But this isn't the end of the story.
So
a woman, and I'm never not going to pronounce her last name right, Cindy Jurasich. Here's about
Cindy the Jurassic Park. Of course.
Yeah. Here's about the Gainesville murders. And is reminded, she's from Shreveport, Louisiana, and is reminded of a series of murders that she heard about back in Shreveport with a very similar story. There was it was a triple murder. It was a 55-year-old William Grissom, a daughter, 25-year-old Julie, and their 8-year-old grandson, Sean. The daughter taped, mouth taped, hands taped, raped and murdered. Cindy Jurasich knew Danny Rollins and had heard some, they used to like associate, and once heard him talking about some kind of a murder thing, and she just had a feeling. So she called Crime Stoppers. The crazy thing about all of this is Danny Rollins, after that final murder, sometime after that final murder, left Gainesville, stole a car, drove to Ocala. They drove to Ocala to rob a Winn-Dixie. While in the Winn-Dixie, he's holding the manager up at gunpoint, demanding the cash. A bookkeeper from the back calls the police, and Danny Rollins is escaping as the police arrive. He gets in the car. There's a high-speed car chase. Jesus. They're driving down. Danny Rollins loses control, crashes into a tree, runs off on foot. The police catch him, arrest him. He's booked. But they have no idea that he's at all related to the murders. So he's in prison for totally unrelated charges, just in there. It's only because of Cindy Jurasich's tip, phone call to Crime Stoppers. She says specifically, you need to check out this dude, Danny Rollins. There's something up with him. I know it. They talk with the Shreveport detectives. They find a match in the blood and they pin him. That's how they captured and charged Danny Rollins for the cases of murder. So he was brought to trial 4 years later. He was diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder, borderline personality disorder, and paraphilia. And 12 years after he was killed by lethal injection in the state of Florida at 6:13, October 25th, 2006.
Wow. Jesus, man, that was the year I graduated high school. That's crazy.
Yeah. So just a couple more things about this. So obviously, like, we're talking about true crime, right? So what is the legacy of all of this, of his life? When they asked him, and I think this is the most important part of, like, maybe our whole project here. When they asked him, what was your motive for all of this? He responded, he wanted to become a superstar, just like Ted Bundy. And since his killings, he has been the subject of 4 major smash hit books, 2 famous movies, and as you told me about before, he was the inspiration for the smash box office hit Scream and the series of movies that followed that. Another independent feature film called The Gainesville Ripper. He's been featured in several primetime TV episodes, including even being the subject of an episode of 2020. Numerous songs, uncountable episodes of podcast episodes. But I think the most striking and most upsetting thing of all is one of the books that was written about him. He actually co-wrote with the help of Sandra London, who became his fiance during the process of interviewing after he had already been arrested, met this man, became his fiance, co-released a book about the murders, made both of them rich in the process. And if that's not upsetting enough to you, like, that there's clearly
upsetting.
I'm
upset.
If that's not upsetting enough to you, this was the second time she had done this. Earlier, she had been the boyfriend of a different Florida-based serial killer who was an ex-cop, releasing a set of fictional short stories, which were basically loosely based autobiographical stories about the killings that this cop did, called Killer Fiction. And she, awful
God.
Name, right?
Oh my God, that book alone, she should go to the electric chair. Yeah. Jesus Christ.
And so that's basically the legacy, the story and legacy of the Gainesville Ripper. Whether or not this is, like, offensive, I mean, I think it's really offensive. I don't think it's really that much in question, but
color me offended. I draw the line at murder.
Anyway, that's what I got for you. That was my first ever true crime. Thank you very much. Yeah. Thoughts?
Well, sure. I think you did a phenomenal job. It's always great to hear about a little color in our, state of Gainesville. And I remember, like, I feel like there is this period of time where, like, every University of Florida student learns about the Gainesville Ripper mm-hmm. and does their own independent research and then makes a decision about staying or leaving. because it is. It's so fucked up. Like, I remember, you know what's so funny, too, is, like, I had forgotten about the murder where he decapitates her and, like, has her head facing.
Oh, my God.
The other thing. And you know what's crazy? I remember this. No, I remember this. I was working at... I was, like, working off Archer Road. I was working as a leasing consultant at an apartment complex. And the maintenance guy at that apartment complex told me he was the maintenance guy at the complex where they found, like, the severed head or something. And I don't know if that's true, but I remember him telling me about that. Like, I remember him just, like, randomly starting a conversation with me one day. And he was like, "Yeah, say, are you new here?" And I was like, "Yeah." He's like, "You been in Gainesville long?" Like, "No, I've only been here a couple months." And he's like, "You ever heard about the Gainesville Ripper?" And I was like,
"What is this accent?"
That's how we talked. He's like, "Stop, I'm Lenny." So
Jesus.
He was, I swear to God, this is a real person.
All right, sure.
And I've got references. I will let you talk to them. Remember, like, him just, like, asking me if I'd heard of the Gainesville Ripper. And then when I said no, like, his eyes fucking lit up and he just, like, slithered over to the desk where I worked. And he was like, "Let me tell you a story." And then he proceeded to tell me about this, like, stuff. Very delightful. Again, like, there is this, like, sick, twisted pleasure in, like, kind of having this, you know, like, we've got a serial killer. Like, we've really made it, you know?
Yeah. Oh, my God. Well, you know what's interesting is all of the murders happened along Archer Road. All of them. Between 34th and 13th where his campsite was. So it was like right along. I looked, we have a mutual friend who lives off of Archer Road, Rachel. And it's less, I mean, it's one of the murders happened just next to where she lives, which is actually
Jesus
kind of crazy.
Christ.
Yeah.
That's so fucking, yeah, I don't know. It's chilling. Honestly, it's fucking chilling. You know what I want to do? I'm going to look, I want to take a look at what Danny Rollins looks like. I'm curious to
He's
know.
He's not and unattractive. That's kind of one of the weirder, it's not that is, I mean, it's not good looking.
Danny Roll, is it Rolling? Rollings?
Rolling, yeah. Rolling. Maybe Rolling, I said okay. Rollins Danny or something. But
okay, well, it's fine. Danny Rolling, Danny Rolling. Jesus Christ. Well, I mean, I don't know. I don't know. I'm not seeing any younger pictures of him.
Yeah. I mean, he's not ugly. He's not, he's like, he was a tall guy. He was 6'2".
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I certainly wasn't, I mean, and at the time of the murders, he was like, I believe like in his 40s or late 30s or something like that. Like, you know, clearly had no place in a college town for,
Jesus.
Not that that matters.
Fucking Christ, man. I'm like looking at his like little fucking encampment in the Gainesville woods. Like fucking, oh my God. That's fucking terrifying, dude. Just knowing this fucking ghoul lived in the fucking forest like a gremlin. Like that's fucking terrifying.
That's pretty nuts.
Yeah. Well, fuck, man. Are you ready for another one?
Yeah. Do we, I guess, do we want to do like a quick lighting change?
Yes, let's.
All right.
Woo!
Oh!
Look at this color scheme.
You look great.
That's so nice.
So
That's
weird.
So nice.
I got a whiskey drink.
Like what? Where's mine? I didn't get that at all.
You didn't get a whiskey drink. I guess that makes I'm better. So.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, anyway. So one of the reasons I chose this particular group of serial killers is because I did some research on the internet, and apparently, like, a lot of people had been asking on some of the, like, the more common, more popular true crime podcasts of, like, My Favorite Murder, Last Podcast on the Left, when they were going to cover this particular set of killers. And some people said that, for at least for the My Favorite Murder crew, it was too fucked up. They didn't want to touch it. Maybe, I don't know of last, like I tried to find it and it kept redirecting me to the Toy Box Killer. So I don't know that they've done it either. Maybe because it's too hard to make this one funny. I'm not sure. But I thought, all right, if I'm going to do true crime, if I'm really going to dive in, I'm going to find I'm going to like just go hard. And actually, this is a lie. I was going to cop out. I was totally going to cop out and do an art thief. And because I thought that would be less scary. And Shay was like, I don't know if that's necessarily true to the experiment. And I went, oh, you're right. Okay. So I went the complete opposite direction. And I found what I think maybe like the kind of the most fucked up. Though I do think I've kind of watered it down a little bit. Because honestly, like, you know, I struggle to like really fucking talk about this nonchalantly. And like, I really had a hard time turning this into content. So I did it the only way I knew how. And well, ladies and gentlemen, this is my version of Camp Re-Education's true crime story of the Toolbox Killer. So, Shay,
the Toolbox Killer. I'm excited.
Yeah. So the Toolbox Killers were a pair of American serial killers comprised of Lawrence Sigmund Bittaker. I'm sorry. Comprised of Lawrence Sigmund Bittaker and Roy Lewis Norris.
Okay.
And they are infamous for kidnapping, raping, torturing, and killing, much like the Gainesville Ripper. I mean, five teenage girls in Southern California over a period of 5 months in 1979. And Shay, would you like to just take a stab in the dark at why they call them the Toolbox Killers?
Wow, this is fun and fucked up. Something for the whole family. Let's see.
Toolbox killers, why are they killing me?
God. We already so much to regret.
Oh my God.
My guess is that they had a toolbox full of special tools used for experiments and sexual stuff and whatever.
More or less, yeah. Okay. They were called the Toolbox Killers because of their use of pliers on their victims, ice picks, sledgehammers, and wires to torture, violate, and kill their victims in their van that they nicknamed Murder Mac.
Holy shit.
Yeah. How do you... Oh, yeah.
I'm just already like, I'm just like, how do you find someone that wants to do that also? Like, how do two of those people come together?
Well, Shay, I'm glad you asked, because let's go back, shall we? Before the sunny, groovy times in Southern California's 1979 skies to 1940 Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Sorry, friend of the show, Andy, Andrew Nocillery. And Bittaker, our first killer, was born on September 27th, 1940. He was the unwanted child of a couple who did not want to have children and was placed in an orphanage by his birth mother and adopted by the Bittaker family as an infant, all right? And I think where a serial killer is concerned, we all know what happened next. Shay, money odds on shitty childhood?
I thought you were going to say murdered both of his parents.
Oh my God, what the fuck?
I feel like that's...
This isn't Rosemary's Baby.
That's what happened with my guy.
Okay. Fair. Totally fair. No, his dad lived. His dad didn't die.
Well, he tried to murder him. He just didn't do a good job.
Trying is not doing, Shay. Right. Like, you either... There is no... Quote Yoda, there is no try, there is only do. So he did not.
Okay, fair.
All right. So his adoptive father worked in aviation, and the family was constantly moving around the U.S. throughout his childhood. And it wasn't long after these moves that the crime started. Bittaker was first arrested for shoplifting at only 12 years old. Over the next 4 years, he would continue to be arrested for theft, which he claims were cries for attention to get his parents to love him, as they constantly ignored him. He was reported to have an IQ of 138 and dropped out of high school in 1957 after his family moved to California. Shortly thereafter, he was arrested for car theft, a hit and run, and evading arrest. He was imprisoned for one year for stealing a car, hitting someone with it, and then running from the cop. What the fuck was going on in the 1970s? Now you sneeze on a cop and you've got life in jail.
Jesus. So,
1 year. He was imprisoned for these offenses for 1 year, and then after being released from prison, discovered that his adoptive parents disowned him and moved to another state, and he never saw them again.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's where we're going to come back to Bittaker in a second, and now we're going to learn about our second killer, Norris. So was born in...
Well, before you move on, what's funny is I've always thought of like maybe adopting like later, and knowing that if they fuck up later in life, you can just say, never mind, and leave.
That changes everything.
That's a big plus for me. Like maybe I do want to adopt. Like, I feel like it's a lot more fucked up if it's your blood. But if it's someone else and you're just like, actually, we picked wrong. Like, you're good. You know,
this story just made me double down on being pro-abortion. Like, there's always these commercials like, what if you aborted the next person that cured cancer? It's like, what if you abort the next serial killer? All right? I don't want this kid. He's going to know better.
Jesus.
And he's going to take it out on other people.
Oh my
so
God.
Norris was born in Greeley, Colorado on February 5th, 1948. Conceived out of wedlock. His parents married to avoid the social stigma surrounding birthing bastard children at the time. And we'll talk about this later, but this is what I'm saying when I say, you know, like, I don't believe in evil. Like, society makes these motherfuckers. So Norris's father worked in a scrapyard, and his mother was a drug-addicted housewife. Which, I mean, like what mother wasn't a drug-addicted housewife in the 1950s, okay? Like, that's not special, Norris. In spite of the fact that his extended family lived within, like, walking distance of his parents' home, he was repeatedly placed in the care of foster families throughout the state of Colorado. Of his childhood, Norris recalls his life being full of wrongful accusations when he lived with his biological parents, who were always accusing him of shit he claims he didn't do. Being neglected by many of the foster families he lived with, and being denied sufficient food and clothing, and also being subjected to sexual abuse. So, yeah, I mean, like, already I think you're gonna know what this guy is gonna be guilty of later on, right?
Oof.
So, while living with his birth parents at 16, Norris visited the home of a female relative in her early 20s. He started speaking to her in a sexually suggestive manner, and she ordered him to leave and immediately informed Norris's father. His dad threatened to beat the shit out of him, and in response, Norris stole his father's car, drove into the Rocky Mountains, and tried to commit suicide by injecting pure air into an artery in his arm.
Holy shit.
Yeah. So his dad is like, don't hit on your cousin. And he goes, fuck you, dad. Don't tell me what to do. Steals his dad's car and tries to kill himself.
Holy shit. Like, that is fucking, that is like one of my nightmares.
Fuck, dude. Yeah. Yeah.
I think every time I get any kind of shot, I'm just like watching them flick the fucking needle. I'm like, flick it like at least three more times. Like, I'm so fucking paranoid.
What if you flicked it again? Yeah. So it's like really fucking crazy. So
Jesus.
Yeah. He was later arrested as a runaway. So I guess he didn't go back home straight away either.
How did he not die? I'm fixated on that.
All right. I guess he missed. I don't know. Or maybe he just like, I don't know. Yeah, okay. So what do you mean I can't hit on my cousin? Like, a guy who wants to hit on his cousin, I'm not surprised. He's not getting into medical school. He's not knowing how to inject air into an artery. Okay. Probably doesn't even know what an artery is. He's like, it's the pink thing. So anyway. He gets back home, he's returned home to his parents, who then inform him they never wanted him or his sister, and as soon as they were old enough, they were going to get a divorce. A year later, Norris dropped out of school and joined the Navy. He was stationed in San Diego and deployed to serve in Vietnam in 1969, although he never saw any combat during his four-month tour of duty, and was then honorably discharged. So, I mean, like, already we kind of have our troubled young men. How are you feeling so far? What are you anticipating?
Well, I'm feeling pretty good.
answer.
You know what's funny? I'm really glad you paused here because I'm like, oh yeah, this is like in the narrative arc you learn in high school or whatever. I'm like, oh, we've like established the crew, the character. Yeah. We like get a feel for everyone. And I was like, all right, now the drama starts. And so this is really it's good. You know what it feels like? It feels like I'm watching a horror movie in my brain.
Well, I'm so glad that earlier you asked, how do you meet someone that wants to do stuff like this to other people? And Shay, I've got an answer laid out here for you, okay? So in the years preceding the two, you know what I was going to say? I was going to call them the gentlemen. They're not fucking gentlemen, okay? They're goobers. They're globs of shit. So in the years preceding their killing spree, the two men would find themselves constantly in and out of prison. So this was a pretty long list, and I tried to condense it in like the just a bullet point here. But Bittaker was arrested in 1950. I've got like a list of their arrests. Bittaker was arrested in 1959 for transporting a vehicle across state lines, in 1961 for robbery, in 1964 for parole violation, in 1967 for theft and for leaving the scene of an accident, in 1971 for being arrested for burglary, and then for a longer stint, he served after, in 1974, he assaulted and attempted to murder a young supermarket employee who saw him stealing and said, hey, don't steal, and then he stabbed him.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, so it's like, so we've got our violent guy, which is Bittaker, and then I think you're going to be able to tell which one Norris is after I outline these details.
Okay.
So in 1969, yeah, there's Bittaker and Norris. Norris, like, Bittaker is our muscle, and Norris is our pervert. It's like an even worse version of Mice and Men. It's like the first draft that Faulkner was like, oh God, like I'm throwing this one out. This version sucks.
I'm going to laugh and pretend I get the reference and then we'll move on.
You know, I've never read the book. I think I just like saw on the cover, there's like a big guy and a little guy. And I'm like, yeah, I get it. The big guy's strong and dumb. The little guy is weak and fragile. Yeah. Okay. Of Mice and Men. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So in 1969, Norris was arrested for rape and assault with attempt to commit rape. In 1970, for attempting to break into a woman's house, presumably to sexually assault her. Again in 1970, for assault with a deadly weapon, when he attacked a female college student with a rock and then beat her head against the sidewalk after she refused his advances. And then again in 1975 for rape. And it was there in the California Men's Colony in San Luis Obispo. I guess it's how you pronounce it. Obispo. Boy, it is a fun name for a bad place. Norris met and befriended Bittaker.
So, Obispo. Wait, but,
Obispo.
But wait, but where was it? Sorry.
The California Men's Colony. So,
what's a men's colony?
It makes it sound kind of like a getaway, right? It doesn't sound like a prison at all.
Oh, it's a prison. Oh, okay. Yeah.
What? No, yeah, it wasn't like, they were like, I'm tired of this life of crime. What if I just went to a nice sunny place where I could play basketball? I'm sure that's...
I couldn't tell if it was like a hippie retreat or like a YMCA. It was like, oh no, a prison. Yeah, okay.
Neither of those things. No, I'm sure that's how they felt when the judge sentenced them to go. They're like, I'm sending you to the men's colony in Obispo. They were like, that doesn't sound half bad.
Pretty good.
But it was bad. All right. So it is now we get these two together, and you know, here's I guess what happens to, actually it's worth mentioning this as well. So, you know, they've got kind of like a spotty history. And again, like we talked about this with the fucking Ripper. What the fuck was going on with prison in the 70s? Like, I'm like pro prison reform, but it's like, if you run someone over with a car that you stole from them, like that, you should be in jail for more than a year.
That's so insane. Yeah.
That's fucking crazy to me. So
I agree. We should be locking more people up. I think you're right.
So, you know, but like, this is, you know what? I'm saving this for the end. All right. It's worth mentioning that while in prison, both men received several psychological evaluations from multiple different psychologists. Mm. Bittaker was diagnosed as being highly manipulative, possessing considerable concealed hostility, a borderline psychopath, and unable to acknowledge the consequences of his actions. Norris was diagnosed with severe schizoid personality disorder, classified as a mentally disordered sex offender, but before he was released, he was declared no further danger to others.
Hmm. Looks like someone did a great job in their psychology classes.
Oops, all berries. Oh, oh,
this is a fucked up but perfect analogy.
Jesus Christ. You can't win them all. So anyway. Oh my god.
This is wrong to laugh.
I know. Well, like, dude, let's get the laughter out now because it stops being funny very soon. Okay. So this is the last section where laughter will be allowed, and then it's gonna get very somber, okay? So get your licks in.
All right.
So Bittaker and Norris became acquainted in 1977, seeing each other around the prison and becoming friendly when Norris taught Bittaker how to make jewelry. That's nice.
That is nice.
Yeah. Probably out of human teeth or some shit. I don't fucking know. And after Bittaker saved Norris twice from being attacked by other inmates.
That'll do it.
So, yeah, he said, probably quote the psychologist, don't beat up my mentally disordered sex offender friend. He makes nice bracelets. Nice teeth necklaces.
I feel like a lot of conversations in prison go like that.
Oh my God, Jesus Christ. This guy's not half bad. So by 1978, they'd become quite close. And it's during this time that Norris informs Bittaker that his biggest turn on is seeing frightened young women. Up until this point, Bittaker wasn't known to have committed any sexual assaults. Remember, Bittaker is our violent guy, all right? But having been prone to violence, Bittaker stated that if he ever raped a woman, you know, if I ever did that, I'd kill him so as to not leave any witnesses. In prison, the men regularly start discussing plans to assault and murder teenage girls after their release. This fantasy evolved into their plan to murder one girl of each teenage year from 13 to 19. The two men then vowed to become reacquainted with each other once they were released from prison. Bittaker was released October 15th, 1978, and 3 months later, on January 15th, 1979, Norris was released from prison and moved into his mother's home in Redondo Beach. Shortly thereafter, he received a letter from Bittaker. And in late February of that same year, the two men met at a hotel and rekindled their plan to kidnap and rape girls. It was then that they purchased their van, the Murder Mac that I'd mentioned earlier, which they'd scoped out and was windowless on one side with a large passenger side sliding door. As Bittaker stated that when viewing the door, he realized they could pull up real close to teenage girls and not have to open the doors all the way and snatch them inside.
I know you can't see my reaction, but I am fucking.
I can't.
Oh yeah. I'm sorry. I know. Listener,
I'm like,
Ian.
What do you mean?
I know. Yeah. I realize I'm just sitting here. Like my arms are clenched. I'm like so fucking uncomfortable.
Oh, dude. Already. This is how I felt when you were like, this is a part I'm not excited about either, but it's like, this is it. Like, here we go. So it's like they've, you know, they had their childhoods, they met in prison, they've made their plans. All right, let's get into it.
Fuck.
So I don't want to get like you into too many graphic details as they're really awful, but there's just it. Yeah. So from February to June 1979, for a couple months, they pick up over 20 female hitchhikers as practice. In late April, the two find an isolated fire road in the San Gabriel Mountains where Bittaker broke open the locked gate with a crowbar and replaced the lock with one that he owned.
Wait, I'm sorry. Are you going to explain that practice thing? Because I'm not sure I get that.
They practiced picking up over 20 female hitchhikers. Like, you know, how is the best place to get them in? Like, when they enter, if they poke their head in, can we grab them? Like, you know, where are they most of the time? Like, how can we drive them around? They didn't hurt them.
Oh.
They just picked them up. They practiced with 20 female hitchhikers to kind of like figure out the logistics of, all right, how is this going to work when we start kidnapping, raping, and killing these
So they're
girls?
Just like trying to see like, okay, what do these women do when they're in our van?
Exactly.
Oh my God.
So it's
God.
Just like, all right, and like kind of like thinking about, all right, maybe I'll grab them here, tie them up here. Yeah, like they practice
Holy
with 20
shit.
Women from February to June 1979, okay?
All right.
So, and then they find that isolated fire road in the mountains and they break open the locked gate and then they replace it with their own lock. So it's like they are now the only ones that can get in and out. So they can buy time if they need to. So on June 24th, 1979, Bittaker and Norris kill their first victim, 16-year-old Lucinda Lynn Schaefer. They abduct her by snatching her from the side of the road and dragging her into the van and turn the radio on full volume to drown out the sound of her screams as they bound her arms and legs and gagged her with duct tape. They then proceeded to the fire road that they had scoped out months earlier in the mountains where they previously switched the locks. So just an absolute god-awful detail pulled from the book Alone with the Devil is that Bittaker wrote that Schaefer displayed, and this is his words, just like an absolute fucking psychopath. The girl displayed a magnificent state of self-control and composed acceptance of the conditions of which she had no control. She said she shed no tears, offered no resistance, and expressed no great concern for her safety. I guess she knew what was coming. At the fire road, the two men took turns raping Schaefer. And their subsequent accounts of the actual murder, both men gave differing accounts as to who argued over whether they should release her or kill her. Schaefer apparently pleaded for only a second to pray before Norris manually strangled her. After approximately 45 seconds, he became disturbed by the look in her eyes and ran to the front of the van vomiting. Yeah. Bittaker then tried this approach until Schaefer collapsed to the ground and began convulsing. He then twisted a wire coat hanger around her neck with vice grip pliers until she stopped convulsing and died. She was denied her request to pray before Bittaker and Norris took her life. So that was their first victim of five. Like I'd kind of said as well, like, I'm not going to get into like too many details and I'm going to kind of gloss over the other four or the other three, but it's basically worth mentioning that they killed four more women after this, and each murder grew increasingly more violent and torturous and incorporated more and more of the tools they kept in the chest.
Can I say something? Like the when you're like explaining the plans to me, like there's like a part of me that feels like I'm the woman in the fucking van and you're telling me like, this is what's about to happen to you, Shay. You're about to hear this, and you have no control over the situation. It's like such a weird fucking experience. Like, clearly I don't listen to any fucking true crime, but holy shit, this is so dark.
I think I'm mostly done, but it's just like there's a reason that these two kind of live in infamy, and I'm getting to that point.
No,
so,
yeah, please.
Yeah. So like, so, you know, this is their first, and it's you know, what's so fucking crazy about this is like, there is almost this like human moment where it's like fucking crazy. Like, it's like they almost, you know, stop and like turn around, like realize how fucked up it is what they're doing. Like, after he gets disturbed by the look in her eyes and like runs to the front of the van to throw up. And then the other guy can't bring him, like, either can't physically do it or can't bring himself psychologically to do it. And then like resorts to like wrapping a wire around her neck and tightening it with pliers until she dies. So it's like they almost, they get so close to like not becoming monsters, and then it just snowballs out of control. So
Jesus,
with each murder following their first victim, man, each murder gets more violent and torturous and incorporates more and more of the tools they keep in the chest, including methods such as jamming ice picks in their victims' ears, bludgeoning them with sledgehammers, forcing them to pose for pictures before and after assaulting them, stabbing their breasts, using vice grip pliers to tear off parts of their flesh, wrapping wires around their neck to strangle them, and even recording audio of these instances, which is partly why they were convicted and why they live on in such infamy, which we'll cover in a second. So their final victim was 16-year-old Shirley Lynette Ledford on October 31st, 1979. So it's fucking Halloween, man. She was abducted as she stood outside a gas station hitchhiking home from a Halloween party in the Los Angeles suburbs. Investigators believe she accepted the ride home from Bittaker and Norris because she recognized Bittaker as a patron at the restaurant where she worked as a part-time waitress. As you could probably guess, rather than drive her home, Bittaker drove the van down a secluded street where Norris drew a knife and then bound and gagged Ledford with construction tape. Bittaker and Norris then traded places as Norris drove the van aimlessly around town for over an hour while Bittaker tortured Ledford in the back. So this is what's fucked up. I mean, this is what's fucked up. It's all fucked up. But much of what happened over the last few hours of Ledford's life is known because the two men recorded the torture session. And I'll tell you this, all right? Last night, I read some of the transcript, and I really wish I hadn't. And I would advise anybody listening to this to never, ever fucking do that, because I lost a decent amount of sleep last night after reading it, and it's just so fucking upsetting. And I'll give you some of the details to give you an idea, but yeah, after removing the construction tape from Ledford's mouth and legs, Bittaker started slapping and mocking her, Ledford, and then beating her with his fists as she shouted for her to say something. She started screaming after this, and then Bittaker started tormenting her to scream louder. Then he started hitting her and asking her, "What's the matter? Don't you like to scream?" On this portion of the tape with Bittaker, you can hear the man rape, sodomize, beat, and torture Ledford, as well as the chilling sounds of either the pliers or the sledgehammer being pulled from the toolbox to be used on her. Then Nora switched places with Bittaker and resumed the psychological torture of Ledford by making her scream with the promise that if she didn't, he would give her something to scream about. Ledford pleaded that she would scream if they stopped hitting her, and she emitted several high-pitched screams as Norris encouraged her to continue until ordering her to stop. Norris can then be heard grabbing the sledgehammer from the toolbox and hitting Ledford's elbow 25 times with it before asking her, "What are you sniveling about?" He fractured her elbow bone several times. After 2 hours of this, Ledford can be heard on the recording screaming for them to end her life. Norris strangles Ledford to death with the wire coat hanger, which has become kind of custom for them, and they tightened with pliers until she died. Where the men had previously disposed of other girls in the mountains or dumped their bodies over cliffs, for some reason with Ledford, they decided to discard her body on a random front lawn in order to view the reaction from the press. Her body was found by a jogger the following morning, and an autopsy revealed that in addition to having been sexually violated, she died of blunt force trauma to the face, head, breasts, and left elbow. Her genitalia and rectum had also been torn, caused in part by Bittaker's use of pliers. Her left hand also bore a puncture wound, and a finger on her right hand had been slashed. So, you might think that that's how they get caught, but it's even dumber than that. Like, so I think they've got plans to do this more. Actually, no, they do. They do have plans to do this more because apparently they've recently purchased acid to use on their next victim. So don't worry, there is no next victim. The good news is there is no next victim.
Which kind of acid, like dissolving body acid or like hallucinogen acid?
Dissolving body acid.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and again, like I said, each instance got more and more violent and more fucked up. So what basically brings their reign of terror to an end is Norris meets up with this guy named Joseph Jackson, who's one of his other fucking buddies from the California men's colony. And when Jackson goes like, so, hey, what have you been up to? Norris confesses to kidnapping women and raping and killing them. So this Jackson guy is like, I'm sorry, what the fuck? And after their meeting, goes pretty much like to his attorney. And I'm speculating that maybe he was on parole. And in the session with his parole officer is like, can I ask you a hypothetical question or something like that? And Jackson's attorney basically goes, oh, fuck yeah, tell the cops. Tell the cops yesterday. So after the cops are informed, they begin to surveil these two fucking goons and arrest them after they catch Norris dealing marijuana and violating parole. And then basically once they kind of get under the watchful eyes of the police, they like show Bittaker's picture to some women and one of them IDs him as her rapist. And they're like, oh, then fuck this guy. He's going to jail. So of course, they search Bittaker's apartment. They find several of the photographs I'd mentioned that they took of the women they were torturing. And while they search the van, they find all of the fucking, just the fucking show of horrors, like torture tools, two of the victims' necklaces, and then, of course, the tape recording of a woman in obvious distress, screaming and pleading for mercy while being sexually abused. So on March 18th, 1980, Norris pleads guilty to 4 counts of first-degree murder and 1 count of second-degree murder, 2 counts of rape, and 1 count of robbery, and was sentenced to 45 years to life in imprisonment with eligibility for parole in 2010. So that's our, yeah, like, which is fucking crazy, for cooperation. Because he's basically like, I'll tell you everything. I'll tell you every fucking detail, and I'm going to blame Bittaker. And that's pretty much what he did. And he was like, this is like Bittaker's whole thing. Like, I just went along with Bittaker's plan. I was scared of him. So Bittaker gets arraigned for this on April 24th, 1980, on 29 charges of kidnapping, rape, sodomy, murder, and a little more even. They find some other stuff to add on there. When asked by the judge how he pleads, he remains silent. And in response, the judge enters a plea of not guilty on his behalf, and he goes to trial on January 19th, 1981. So like I said, Norris kind of like cooperates, right? And he's like, oh, I'll tell you everything. Like Norris was the mastermind, or Bittaker was the mastermind. I was just a patsy. So the star witness of Bittaker's trial is Norris, who cooperates and goes into the events that unfolded in great detail, framing the story. Like I just said, like he just kind of went along with Bittaker's ideas. And part of the reason he went through all these acts was because he feared for his life. So they go through all of this evidence at trial, the testimony, the torture weapons, the Polaroids. But the most damning evidence is the 17-minute section of audio tape of Ledford's abuse and torment, where the jury learns that Norris was just as, if not more, involved in what happened to Ledford than he let on. So this tape is kind of why, like, these two, like I said, live on in such infamy, because I know that we have, like, it's left to our imagination a lot of these times. Like when we hear about all these other serial killers and we hear about like Gacy and Bundy and the Gainesville Ripper, like we know what happened, but in terms of like how it unfolded, it's very quick. You know, you say what happened, like, oh yeah, broke into the apartment, stabbed, killed, the end. They had to listen to a 17-minute section of audio tape that apparently just dragged out in this courtroom. Before they played the tape, Stephen Kay, the attorney, forewarned the jury, for those of you who do not know what hell is like, you're about to find out. There were over 100 people present in the courtroom as the tape was played, and many members of both the jury and the audience openly wept upon hearing the contents. Several members of the audience either burying their heads in their hands, dabbing tears from their eyes, or rushing out of the courtroom before the tape had finished. There are some urban legends that people in the courtroom also vomited or left to vomit. When Kay was questioned by reporters whether the audio tape should have been introduced into evidence, given the obvious trauma it caused everyone in the courtroom, he simply responded, the jury needs to know what those two did. So, just a few more details about this tape, which makes this case like stand out from others. Paul Bynum was the chief investigator of these murders, and he committed suicide in December 1987 at 39 years old. And in a 10-page suicide note, he specifically refers to the murders and like the contents of the trial as to like why he decided to kill himself, like haunting him. In interviews, it was stated that for 2 years following the trial of Lawrence and Bittaker, the chief attorney, whose name I just forgot, Stephen Kay, reported like nightmares constantly where he'd be rushing to the van to like prevent harm coming to the girls and like the screams coming from the van. And like he would always get there too late in his dreams. Another weird detail about this is when Scott Glenn was preparing for the role of Detective Jack Crawford in Silence of the Lambs, he went to speak with the FBI profiler, John Douglas, who when kind of like asked like, you know, like, oh, I want to be part of your world. John Douglas goes, you want to be part of my world? And played the tape for Scott Glenn, who asked him to turn it off apparently after 1 minute. And different versions of the story have Scott Glenn reacting a number of ways, some being like that he started crying and others being that he threw up in like the trash can next to him. And probably the weirdest detail about this tape is that the audio cassette Bittaker and Norris created of themselves raping and torturing Ledford remains in the possession of the FBI Academy, where this recording is now used to train and desensitize FBI agents to the raw reality of torture and murder. In any case, Bittaker was sentenced to death for the 5 counts of first-degree murder upon which the prosecution had sought the death penalty. He showed no emotion as the verdict was delivered, though he was never actually executed and died on death row on December 13th, 2019, of natural causes. Norris also died in prison of natural causes on February 24th, 2020. And that is the end of the story of the Toolbox Murderers.
Fuck, dude. That's so fucking fucked. I know, like...
I'm not a fan.
Dude, I knew that it was going to be intense.
Bad?
Yeah, but like the reaction I'm having right now is like it's weird because I am speechless, which I understand as a podcaster.
Like it's not good.
It's not good. So it's like, all right, well, don't be speechless right now, Shay. Like fight your natural reaction because you're an entertainer in the face of like absurd inhumanity, and I really don't know what to make of it.
Yeah. Oh man, should we go to How Brain How Feel?
Yeah, let's go to How Brain How Feel.
Hi everyone, welcome to How Brain How Feel. This our what used to be our favorite end of camp recap to see if and how our minds have changed. Or if we've just become convinced of our initial, more convinced of our initial preconceptions. Obviously, Shay and I are audibly struggling, visually struggling if you're watching the show. God damn, Shay, you just completely killed the rest of that glass of whiskey. Yeah, we're having a hard time. We are having a hard time.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
So, okay. I'll start. Cause, okay.
Sure, yeah.
So... like your reaction right now is how I was feeling last night, especially after reading the transcript of this, where I was like physically, emotionally, and psychologically upset to the extent that I was mad at you last night.
Me?
I was mad at you because I wanted to do, oh. I didn't feel like I'm over it now, but like after reading that, I was mad because I wanted to do, remember, like I was like, oh, I'll just do like, I'm and I did, right. I admit it was kind of a cop out. To do like the art robbery because I knew the shit would upset me. And right. I knew, you know, just like it's like visually upsetting you. Like that sure. was me last night.
Yeah.
And I kind of like blamed you. And I was like, fuck, man. I was like, fuck, God damn it. I just wanted to do a fucking art robbery story. I don't want to fucking read about this shit. I don't want to know this. Yeah. So it's like, I almost feel like you're a little mad at me for like picking this story, right? Or you're like, oh my God, like why did Ian pick this one?
Honestly, I'm not mad at you at all. No, you know, I feel like it was a really important experience for me in some ways. Like this was really disturbing in like a lot of ways. And like, I imagine any listener right now, probably not totally, maybe I'm wrong, but I imagine like when I've listened to true crime before, there's like some kind of disconnect because like I can talk to you right now. I can be like, Ian, like,
why did you do this?
Yeah, or that. You know?
Don't go on. Please don't go on.
Please, no more information. And it's like, not only that, it's like, I have to participate. I can't just be like, nope, pause, or like, I'm going to distract myself and like only kind of listen. Or like, I'm gonna pay a little bit more attention to my dishes right now, or whatever the other thing is. So I have to like really be in this fucking world with you. And I think it's important for me because I'm not really sure that I would have really appreciated the intensity in any other way. Like if I'd listened to My Favorite Murder do this, I don't think I'd care as much. I'd be like, I'm not there with you. I'm not like in that world.
Yeah.
It's something else. It really, really is.
Well, and like, it's like, I don't know, like telling the story, like listening, there's no responsibility in listening to the story, but there is absolutely a responsibility in telling the story.
Right.
And I believe that now more than ever because, you know, it's anyone that creates content probably thinks about how it's going to be curated. And you and I had an argument behind the scenes about cutting things short. Right. And I was very distressed at the idea that I would have to leave out these details, which is like, I already trimmed so many. Mm-hmm. So it's like, I don't know, man. Like, I the way it is right now, like, I think it's just okay enough to tell. So I was feeling like some very serious anxiety because I was worried that like, you know, yeah, like I said, I feel like I picked everything and kind of like presented it in such a way that it would be just palatable enough, but like just it like leave enough dignity for the people that were subjected to this. Like, God.
I think you honestly, man, I think you did a really phenomenal job as someone who consumes virtually no true crime at all. I think this was a truly stellar performance on your end. So,
oh, thanks. Well, yeah, I can see why the My Favorite Murder team did not include this in their repertoire, and maybe even why and like I said, I don't know if the last podcast guys didn't do this one, but like, fuck, man, after reading that transcript, like I don't know how you can make that like a yeehaw, rootin' tootin' good time.
You know what, dude? Like, I don't know. Okay. So I guess like for How Brain How Feel, it's like, how do we feel? Like now, like, all right, so like I can tell you right now, doing the true crime part, yesterday when I did mine on the Gainesville Ripper, like I was sitting in my, so a couple things about this. Like I was sitting in my living room. I was reading like several different versions of how everything played out and like going through like graphic detail. I left out a ton of information because I wasn't sure what to include. You know, I was like, what do you say? What do you not? And I'm going through it and I'm like, okay, like I really don't want to talk about this that much. But like sitting there last night, I was like, this is fucking upsetting as shit. Like there's multiple times where you're just reading and you just like wince and like turn away and you're like, holy fuck, that's insane. And you're like, guess I'll keep reading. And you keep going and you keep going. But I will say telling it today wasn't as bad. And, you know, and like maybe it's because of leaving out the details. Maybe it's because there's like some connection to Gainesville that we could like play with in a way that like distracted from the seriousness of it. Like that felt okay. But I will say that all of that was okay. Hearing you tell this story, that was the most fucked up thing. honestly, and like I think part of that, to your infinite credit, is how good of a job you did telling that story. I think you did a phenomenal job. But fuck, man, it's funny, when I'm at a loss for words, I might ramble. I feel like that's like kind of where I'm at right now. I'm rambling because I'm speechless.
So I want to bring something else up that we talked about too. Like when we talked about us being shocked at the jail thing, and it's funny because like we're shocked at the jail thing because we know it's coming.
Right.
Like this guy only got a year in prison. It's like, I mean, to the, like, I don't know, the system's quote unquote credit, not that I want to give it any at all. They didn't know that this was going to happen, but I don't know about you. I'll ask you first, and then I guess I'll answer. Are you more or less convinced of the existence in evil after reading like some of these stories?
Dude, I don't think so. And the reason, and I guess anyone listening who maybe didn't listen to the last episode, like we talked about, like is evil even really a thing? And like every one of these people, I mean, only three or, you know, however many people we talked about, like they all had insanely fucked up
lives,
upbringings, particularly. Yeah. Like their childhoods were insane, and like it's literally like I don't know. This is like almost an inhuman metaphor in the sense that like it's like robotic, but like we are all programmed as children to like know how to interact in the simulation of life, you know? And so like if your programmers are beating you and teaching you that pain and violence and suffering and abuse and humiliation,
back to life,
then you're like, okay, well, this is life. And this is like the person who's supposed to protect and love me more than anything sexually abuses and beats me. Well, then clearly the kindest act I can do to anyone else is to beat and sexually assault them as well. You know, and it's like, well, your whole fucking worldview is turned upside down. So
shattered,
Is that evil or is that just like, no, like it's a bad, I don't, this is super inhuman the way I'm going to say this, but is that just bad programming?
You know, no, because I agree with you. I agree with you 100%. You know, it's funny when I was thinking about Bittaker and fuck Nelson. Like I just did a whole fucking story about Bittaker and Norris. Mm. Like beyond just what happened in their household, like you're talking about, you know, boys that were coming of age in like the 1950s and 60s. Like we're talking about them growing up in a world where, you know, the well-being of half the country, you know, depending on the color of your skin, didn't matter. You're growing up in a world where women are to be seen and not heard. You're growing up in a world where like might is right, you know, like there's all kinds of cultural paranoia with like the dawning of the Cold War. Like there's photos of Bittaker and Norris, I think like around covers of Hustlers. Like they're growing up in a pop culture where like women are to be bought and sold for pleasure. Like it's not beyond what just happened in their homes. Like it's also, you know, how their families were programmed to behave as well. Like Norris's parents marrying because it wasn't socially acceptable to have a child out of wedlock, you know? And it's just, it's just like, I believe that it was Kay, the lawyer, Stephen Kay. He was like, I am a huge proponent of the death penalty after this. And if you don't want to make any changes to the system, I'd be inclined to agree with you. But like, if that's the only opinion that changes, that you the only difference in opinion that you come out of that experience with, it's like, I think you're missing the bigger picture, you know, where it's just like, again, like these people were made, you know, they weren't born. Yeah. And I'm sure that's not a popular opinion, but it's just like, you really be, and I love it. You know, the parallel you make between parents, you know, like if the people that are supposed to love and protect me do this to me, then this is the nicest thing I can do to another person too. I think it's that. And then I think it's the influence of the culture at large. And you need to take a fucking magnifying glass up to that and be like, how are we preparing people to grow up? And it's funny because serial killing is a lot less popular now than it was, you know?
Is that a fact?
You know, it feels right. And like Andrew said on the last, I think so. I think so. I could be wrong. And technology also probably has a large part to play with that. But,
you know, I imagine that it's harder to get away with serial killing now than it ever was. Because it's funny because like even in the Gainesville Ripper thing, they didn't have DNA evidence. They were like, oh, the blood type matches. That's how we know.
That's crazy.
And it's like, oh, yeah. I mean, but like there are only so many different types of blood types where like there's only one, you know, DNA for each
DNA,
person.
Yeah, man, fuck. I mean, I don't know. So it's like, so my opinion on like punitive justice hasn't changed.
Yeah.
Like, you know, these guys got thrown in jail. Like they, and I'm really willing to bet that was based on punishment, not rehabilitation. And, you know, Norris got ready to ship off to the Vietnam War. And like, even though he didn't see any fucking like combat, just being in fucking Vietnam in the Vietnam War had to be fucking traumatizing to
you know
a young
what?
Man.
Fucking Danny Rowling was also in the Air Force. I didn't mention it, but he was in the Air Force. He got, I believe he got dishonorably discharged, actually.
Getting ready to go to war and being put into the position to literally like learn to dehumanize, learn to otherize and be like, you know, it's kill or be killed. It's you or them. Like these, for all intents and purposes, for your safety and well-being, you are not going into a war against people. You are going into a war against targets, and targets are things. They are not people.
Right.
So it's just like, yeah, like so much goes into, you know, not to rip off that title, like making a murderer, you know, and it's just like, again, like these people weren't a fucking accident. You know, I mean, you could try, you'd be like, whoops, you know, oops, all berries, but it's just like,
listen,
yeah,
I like it's intense. Let's take a break. Let's take a break from the intensity and let's have a good night. I know it's, you know, what's funny is like to any listeners who just want a quick Camp Re-Education trivia, we used to record in the mornings. Now we record at nights and it's getting late. And it's like, I know for a fact, this is going to be on my mind. You know, it's going to be like,
yeah,
I'm going to walk away from this. We're going to stop recording. We're going to say our goodbyes. I'm going to go into the other room and check on my girlfriend. And she'll be like, how was recording? And I'll be like, fuck, dude, I have no fucking idea. I'm a mess. You know, I don't know who I am or what's important right now. It's just like, will you just hold me? And then she'll say, you know, I'm not really feeling it. And I'll be like, that's fine. I'll go lay alone. So
yeah, and then I'll get that you know, dreaded text from Shay, you up.
You know, and just some other Camper Education trivia. I saw Ian's wife, she hates being on camera, so she puts a sheet over her head now whenever she walks behind Ian. So I saw Ghost Ju-Yun come by, and so I know Ian will have to go tend to Ghost Ju-Yun once.
Yeah, I will.
So yeah.
Well, are we parting ways here? Are we kind of like many of these cases leaving this one unsolved, leaving this stone unturned?
You know, I think, you know, frankly,
yes.
There was a lot of the stone we got under, but the stone, we've peeked under enough of the stone. I don't think we need to lift it up any higher.
Yeah, more than we bargained for sure.
For sure. I didn't expect it, but honestly, I do feel like it was a good experience for me. So, yeah.
Definitely a new one for the feeling books. This is just like, oh, this is a new feeling. This combination of horror, shame, and obligation.
Yeah. So, I guess for the listeners, we got some good stuff coming up in the future. We have our next episode, I think, should be an amazing sleepover with Isabel Hagen. We had an amazing conversation with her. Such a funny person and a great comedian. We're also stoked. It's so weird to like this like tone shift. I'm just like, and also check out Country Music Camp. And like, do we, whatever, the Country Music Camp's
yeehaw!
Coming up. Yeehaw! Fuck, that's what a weird transition. But
yeah, I know.
Whatever, Country Music Camp's coming up. It should be great.
I mean, you know what? Yeah, we can't. It's going to be great. We can't turn it off. We're not a true crime podcast. We just try shit out. So it's like, you're either, the people that make this shit are either like very resilient or they're fucking psychopaths.
Yes, dude. I'm so glad you mentioned that because I was like, I know I'm a sensitive dude and I just like cannot imagine like the psychological walls that the My Favorite Murder women have in order to like live in this world. Same for like Last Podcast guys and like, you know, all the other podcasts that do this shit. So it's kudos. Hats off. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, anyway, that sound that you're hearing now is the featured artist we promised you at the beginning of the episode. So hopefully to kind of shake off those awful icky feelings is this week's featured artist, Piper King. Not that bad. So let's see if they can make the hurt go away. You already mine.
very special thanks to you, the listener, for listening. To hear interviews and other bonus content in their entirety, become a monthly supporter and join our Patreon, where you'll get access to those and tons of other fun goodies.
Here at Camp, we love talking over great music. If you want to hear more amazing music like the song you're hearing now, then follow our playlist on Spotify.
We hope you enjoy this camp as much as we did. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and everywhere else. Stay tuned for our next camp where we yeehaw, badoing, badoing, yalaloo!
Well, shucks, partner, next time on Camp Free Education, I fucked my sister in the barn with a big old ball of yarn, cause I'm country, country, country.